Actually, let me just get started. Good morning. I'm not as funny as the comedian at the beginning and not as smart as Diraj, but I'll try my best in the next 45 minutes to give you some insights on what I think is important. And that is what I call the art of social data. If we look at what we have here, we have, starting with inquisitive analytics or exploration of data, then describing things, making predictions, and making prescriptions. So I completely believe what I think most of you are on board here with, that the goal of what we have is to make better decisions based on data. So I actually want to push in this talk in a couple of directions. One is, I want to talk about a different data source which you might not be super familiar with, namely what I call social data. So in the first part, I will tell you what social data actually is. In the second part, I will tell you about three perspectives on social data. The perspective of the individual, think the customer. The perspective of arcs between individuals or relationships, think C2C. And then the third one is what I call the social playground or the community that emerges. So we start with the individual, we look at relationships the data connections produce, and then we see what the whole, often more than the sum of its parts, produces. In the third and last part of the talk, I will show you three areas of behavior change through social data. The first one is, how does the attitude the company has towards its customers change? The second one is, how does the product development process, how does the product innovation process in the company change? And the third one is, how does the company culture change? Now, is there somebody who can help me with getting the PowerPoint up? Or should we just, there's a password needed? Yeah, okay, sorry about that. I want this to be relatively interactive. So if there are things which I'm saying that you have comments on, I think I'm open for getting quick answers during the talk. We don't have to push everything till the end of the presentation. Okay, I would like to start by giving you a bit of my own background. And I would also like to link it to what you're doing, namely doing data. And I'll do it by decades. The 70s for me was a time when we built computers. I was in high school and I do remember sort of putting stuff together, soldering, etc. 70s, building computers. The 80s was, I would think, about connecting computers. And typically modems. Just last week I was in an undergraduate dorm at Stanford and I was not able to tell people what a modem is because it's just so not part of their lives anymore. Amazing. So the 80s was about connecting computers. I was at CERN in Geneva where I worked in a collaboration, international collaboration. It was just amazing to be at one place and being connected and running jobs and all kinds of computers elsewhere. The 90s, I would say, was not about connecting computers, but connecting pages. We moved from getting a modem dial tone to actually hyperlinks, all right? The 2000s, I would say, moved from connecting pages to connecting people. If you think about it, most of us are actually in the business of most of what we do to connect to people, not so much to pages. And we, most of us, have forgotten about computers. So now my question to you is, what do you think the 2010s are about? So after building computers, connecting computers, connecting pages, connecting people, what do you think this decade is about? Connecting communities. I think actually it's about connecting data. because there's just so much around there. Most of it is implicitly created as we go along. And of course, every now and then, we knowingly and willingly share something. That's what I call social data. And think Facebook, or think Twitter as examples for that. But it's really making sense out of the plethora of data that are not connected standalone, but that are created, that are not created standalone, but that are created in a connected way. For example, think geolocation. If you were to give up all of your geolocation data, let's say on a 15-minute by 15-minute basis, versus, if I give you the choice, you have to give up all the header information of all of your emails and texts. What if you were forced to give up one of the two? What would you rather give up? Your geolocation, your traces to the real world, or all of the header information, who you sent what to, at what time, with what subject line, and what you got? What's your feeling? Who would rather give up every single 50 minutes where exactly they are, longitude and latitude? And who would rather have us see all the header information? Hey, what about the rest? Let me give you a third choice. All the queries you go on Google or Yahoo. Who would rather give that up? Every single query. No. So all these are examples, in the case of geolocation, of data which we produce anyways. Google latitude being a good example. We don't even have to check in somewhere, which in the case of header information, we are very aware of. And in the case of queries, we are also aware of, but we don't really think that we are actually giving, in this case, Google that much information. So the questions which emerge here about social data, the data we share, are to a large degree social questions, societal questions. If you think about the big privacy debate, the trade-offs people make by just wanting to get stuff done more easily, and in exchange of that, what they actually share with companies. So it is not that it's a technology question only. Mu Sigma is doing a wonderful job to making that job easy for you. My job here is to actually help you think what else you could be doing, to help you inspire about what the next step might be, what other things you could be doing. And as I said, I will start with the economics of social data. So if you think back, many businesses were engineered or were designed around constraints that existed in a certain time. So for instance, the constraint of communication being expensive led to the very formation of companies. Because 100 years ago, it was much cheaper to communicate within a firm than between firms. Now, communication essentially is free. So if we were designing something around the cost of communication, we're designing it around something which used to be scarce, but is now abundant. What do you think is scarce now? Time. What else? What would you love to get from your customers, all of you, besides money? Identity, you said? Knowing who they really are? Very interesting question. I'm doing a project with Swift, the company which moves $4 trillion around the world every day. And it's precisely on digital identity. So many, many aspects of identity. But I think you mainly want something even simpler from your customers. The attention, right. You want to get the attention. So whereas in the old world, you know, people couldn't measure whether you get somebody's attention, now we actually have many metrics in how we can measure whether we are getting somebody's attention. Like, for instance, they, with the bottles, they are getting our attention right now. So ultimately, our view is that you want to write down equations, equations of the business. And what I want you to realize is that there are new terms in these equations of the business which you might not be considering. And I don't have the perfect solution, but talking about attention, for instance, one term is, do you use the customer attention without giving them something? For instance, being in Chicago here and being a member of United Airlines Mileage Plus program since 1988 and having the co-branded Visa card for decades, getting like every month a credit card solicitation from United/Chase about a card I've had for 20 years is kind of really weird. So they make it clear to me that they know nothing about me and that by sending me something, every time I get something, their reputation goes down further. So that's an example of communication cost being pretty small. It's a buck for the thing. Still, it makes it actually a negative experience. Even more so, of course, in any electronic communication. If you think deeply through what some companies like, I believe, Amazon.com do as a good job in communicating with you, that there's a new book out you might be interested in, but most companies don't. Taking that customer perspective and putting into that equation is actually very important. Here's an example. Who of you has something like a call center where people call in? Okay. So at Amazon, for the call center, we have, of course, had one term, something like $14, for somebody calling the call center. That's sort of from an operational perspective, roughly what it cost. But in most cases, if somebody calls the call center and gets their problem resolved, it's actually net positive for Amazon. Because people say, wow, this is great. I had a problem and they solved my problem. Which, of course, doesn't mean that you should ship something wrong every single time so people call and then you solve their problem. But I mean, everything else being equal, actually a call to the call center is a good thing in the customer's mind. However, a second call about the same case totally sucks, right? So that means if you think about the equation of the business for the call center here, what you had is that whereas the first term was slightly negative, the second term is hugely negative because the problem didn't get resolved the first time, not good news for the company. You have a very unhappy customer. Well, then you peel that onion one layer further. Some past customers indeed are just very unreasonable. For those of you, if I had the chance to listen in into call center conversations, you know, some people just really don't, you know, want to be dealt with in a nice way. But in other cases, call center agents simply maybe make mistakes. And whoever the second call center person is, it's his job or her job to pass judgment on whether the reason for the second call was that it was the first agent who made a mistake or whether it was the customer who just is unreasonable. So now, by instrumenting the call center, if you will, just the little extra button, you immediately get insights into the operation and know what to do. It's not just having the insight, but you really know who those agents are to have conversations with. So that was just the little vignette of an explanation of an example where I want you to see that it's not only about the data analysis, but it's also about the data that you're creating. So in this equation of the business, think of it as a long equation and think about it, what terms for your business you want to have in there, but then also think about what are the weights and how have they shifted. So as a last example here, a macroscopic example from Amazon, when Jeff started Amazon, he was thinking about real estate prices are going up, technology prices are going down. Thus, I'm going to build an e-commerce company. So understanding which of these costs go up, which of the costs go down, and then building a business according to that new vacuum, those new opportunities for the new equations is the first point I want to get across. Now focusing here on social data, examples here would be how people tweet about your products, whether they are happy. And socializing data means that you take things which might have been previously private and make them public. Let me give you another example. When customers call a call center, they often get that message, whether they are okay with that conversation being recorded. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. So I say yes. I mean, what's the big deal? So the other day when I was driving up after the TED conference to the TED after party from Los Angeles to Palm Springs, I had an Avis car. And I picked it up in Los Angeles, I changed my mind, I called Avis, with my permission, the conversation was recorded. And I said, how much is the change, the drop-off fee? And they said, whatever, $200. I said, okay, great, I'll drop it off when I wanted to drop it off, the 1 week in Palm Springs. I arrive Palm Springs, drop my car off, and have a $1,300 charge for a small car for a week. I said, how is this possible? It turned out that somebody in the call center probably just forgot to save or something like this. I don't have a record of that conversation. I mean, I know on my call log that I called Avis, but I didn't record that conversation. So why wouldn't a company be willing to socialize those data in the following sense? To make that MP3 available for the customer for the next year and to reduce the asymmetry between what the company knows and says, sorry, no record of your conversation, and what the customer genuinely believe he actually was told on that phone call. Or think airlines, you put in the blanks here. So when we're talking about social data, think about where you could, without much money, it doesn't cost much to give people access besides it's a fraction of a percent of the people who would actually use such cases. But what does that trust? What does this do for the trust the customer would actually have in you if you were willing to share data with them in a symmetrical way? So social data spans many subject areas. Philosophy, psychology, sociology, there's design elements, behavior economics, of course, technology, machine learning, what I did my PhD in. So all of those things come together and actually create a new world where now things that used to not be possible become possible, where questions that used to be secondary, like privacy, become important. So I want to also ask you where you think in your company the scarcities are. We already talked about the customer attention being important, but is it storage of data? Is it bandwidth? Is it doing the math? Help me out here. Where do you see the bottleneck? If you had one wish, what would your wish be? If I only had cheaper storage, I would be in better shape. Let me hear a couple of bottlenecks from you, from your businesses. The data silos, yes. I was hoping for the D word here. I was worried people would say other things. It's always about data. The silos is also that you might not have the data, that you might not know that somebody else has the data. So that's why when I talk about socializing data, it for me means getting people to share. And that means we need to have incentives so people actually share. Now, before talking about the organizational part at the very end, I want in the perspectives start with the perspective of the individual. I was super impressed by the people who I met last night at dinner, and they all had companies that actually have end users. So I decided to actually spend a little bit of time on the what I call end user, end customer, on the individuals. And I want to ask, why do people create and why do people share data? So one thing is self-expression, that people share stuff because it's one way of creating themselves, of, we are the data we create and share. if you think about Facebook. So why would people do that? Many things in society are shifting because people now have access to data they didn't have access to before. For instance, for my Stanford course, I have hundreds of students who want to take my class, and I take 60 every year. I require that each of them opens their Facebook profile for me. So I can actually get a feeling about whether that person would be able to contribute to the class or whether I'm not sure. So getting access to information they knowingly and willingly share with their friends and thus have their friends debug that information. If they say, hey, I did this yesterday, and they didn't, somebody will comment. It's very different from requiring them to write an essay to get into the course. Seeing who they are connected with is very different from getting a reference from somebody. Because, see, if they're friends with five people who took the class last year or the year before last, I know that they know what they're in for. So decisions like, in my simple case, who do I let into my class, in your case, who do you employ, are very different now through the socialization of data. And that's not just the nudge effect. The IPO of LinkedIn last week might serve as an example to see that socializing data in a job context certainly has changed. So whether it's about finding a job or whether it's about finding a date, I'm on the board of a mobile dating app company, another area of society which is changing. How should we as companies actually help people share data? And that question means, how can we create value to them in exchange to what they share? So people will share anything. People share on Facebook what the KGB wouldn't have gotten out of them under torture. Once. And then it's up to us to tell them that their life is a better life if they share that. I actually started a company in the late 90s called Mood Logic, which was a music recommendation company. And it was pretty clear to people that if they actually honestly, if they truthfully tell us what they think about certain songs, then and only then can we show them songs they will really enjoy. If they put in random numbers, you know, we can't do anything better than getting random songs back to them. So getting the customer to have a mental model that the data they share benefits them down the road. So we go away from the model of, gee, if I tell the company something, they will screw me, to I'm kind of neutral about it, to if I tell the company something honestly, they will help me. Amazon recommendation being another example. Those, I think, that is the mindset for me, which I want you to think about. How can you get the mental model across to the customer so they know that if they're truthful, they will have a better life, as opposed to if they pretend that they have the following features since they think that's how your algorithm works. Recommendations, of course, on the individual level have come a long way, and beyond the purchases, and beyond the clicks which led to the purchases, and beyond that combination, people look at this, eventually buy that. I think my prediction would be that all of that stuff is less than 10% of what social recommendations actually will be doing in the next couple of years. So if you think back the last 10 items you bought, how many of those, I mean, not counting your newspaper and stuff like this, but how many of those actually were discovered through a friend? I think for most of us, it's more than 50%. And by making that sharing easier and easier, the sharing attached to real identity, actually this will become a more and more important part. Social commerce is, I think, with Facebook, one of the biggest threats to Amazon.com. So my belief, however, is that the individual truly is at the center, the end customer truly is at the center, and future of work where you partition tasks and have people around the world, like Musicma for me, do things for you where you don't actually have to create a position in the company, is clearly the way the world with a drop of communication costs is moving. But how do we create the matching algorithms based on the data people share, based on the people, on the data people share and other people comment on? Okay, so that was the first point about individuals and my deep belief that, you know, the world will become a more and more individualistic place in the future. The second point about connections, about relationships, about the social fabric. How do we now weave in a world where communication costs have disappeared? How do we weave people together? How do we instrument the relationships between people? Well, if you think Facebook, Facebook is doing a pretty good job on that, on instrumenting the relationships. It knows if I post something, how long does it take that somebody responds, who do I respond to? And there, the asymmetries in these relationships are particularly important. If there's a friend of mine, as soon as he posts something, I'll jump on and say, great, I like it, I comment. And he never likes anything back from me, never comments on anything I have, then maybe that is an asymmetric relationship. Same is true for trust. Now, if you feed back that information to people, now think back about this. Think in your organization, if you say, hey, if you leave voicemail for Jack, he returns it typically within an hour. Or here's a distribution. If you leave voicemail for Jane, forget about it. How would that change your behavior, leaving voicemail? And how would that change Jane's behavior? Or maybe Jack's behavior? So by showing data about the relationships, you change the behavior pretty much of everybody and of the entire system. I gave an early example about surfacing the behavior of call center agents. In China, I was in Shanghai, whenever I go to China, I get to vote on the agent who actually checks my visa. And above them is displayed how many stars they have. So you don't go anymore to the cutest one, but you just go to the one who is just the most efficient one. It changes my decision-making process who I end up with. It's not just the relationship between people which we instrument. What other relationships are there? There's a relationship between the individual and the product. My iPad, my laptop, my phone, my hotel room. So it's the relationship between me and the brand, me and the company, me and government, me and the city. Smart parking, ParkSF is an experiment of congestion pricing for parking. If there's only one parking spot left at noon in the central business district, maybe it should just be like 10 bucks a minute. Maybe not, maybe that's unfair. But we could do it because we have the data. So we shift the problems from, oh, we can't change the parking meters that quickly, to what a society actually should be doing. So I would argue about the social fabric here, about relationships. We are our relationships. And it's also, for us most importantly, we are the relationships we have with companies. My students always say it's about three things. It's about getting paid, it's about getting laid, and about getting made, as like, you got it made. That's how they see the world. I think, besides the attention, which we talked about at the beginning, it's actually belonging, which is super important in this fragmented world. So if you want to have an ABC of social data, it's attention, belonging, and two-way communication. which is very different from the traditional ABC, which is advertising, branding, some people say bullshitting, and one-way communication or confusion. Now, the third point here is that you want to build social playgrounds. What's the difference between Nike and Nike Plus? Who knows Nike? Okay, who knows Nike Plus? Let me explain it to you. You go to the store or buy it on the internet and you put something in your shoe that knows wherever you're walking. Then you can upload this, for instance, via your iPhone, and put it up on the web. I see you shaking your head, thinking, who would do this? And actually, the right question is not who would do this once, but would people do it again? And the answer is, people do it on average 3 times a week. So isn't that interesting that their runs, they want to share with the world, they want to create a community. And how that shifts is that Nike Plus gets better over time. The more I do, the more I learn. My shoes get worse over time. So when we talk about products, I want you to think about, are these products that benefit from social data by getting better over time? Google, wonderful example, that gets better over time. As people do more and more searches, Google knows how to do the ranking better and better. Or are there products that gets worse over time? Like the plane I came in yesterday, clearly wasn't that category. So does your product get better? If not, what can you do to make it better? Or let me give you another example. So I got a map, you know, a printed piece of paper. And I was thinking that I was actually a big fan of maps. I mean, maps are a wonderful representation of the world. But when did I last look at a map? And maps were great until GPS came along. Now, GPS, of course, tells us where we are, but that wouldn't be great. It tells us what to do. It tells us how to change our behavior in order to get to where we want to be. And GPS was great until, now, until what comes along? Until people-generated traffic data comes along. Because it doesn't help me much when I know that, you know, this route in principle is the best route if I don't know the traffic. So as I arrived O'Hare yesterday, there was a big sign which said, by IBM actually, which said that in Singapore, 90% of all traffic jams get predicted ahead of time, allowing people to circumvent them based on data, they didn't say that part, but based on data, people knowing and willingly contribute. If you just know how the mobile phones are moving in the world, which you have to know because otherwise people couldn't make calls if they don't get handed on from base station to base station, if you just know that, you can actually make better models about traffic than with any super fancy supercomputer without the data. Just to bring my point back home, that think about how can we get people to share data so clearly they're, in this case, driving is a better experience than if they were not to share those data. Another example is insurance. I did a workshop on the Social Data Lab, did a workshop on the future of insurance last week. And we had like the head of innovation of Allstate, another couple of other insurance companies sponsoring it. Given the social data people leave on their playgrounds, how is insurance going to change? Let me give you an example. I was told by one of the insurance people that, of course, a competitor of theirs denied claim to a person who filed for some antidepressant drug because she was just smiling too much on her Facebook pictures. Is that fair? If somebody has all these happy pictures and you deny them coverage for some antidepressant drug? I don't know. We don't know. But as a society, we have to think about it. We have those data out there. What actually do we want to do? Push it one step further. 23andMe. 23andMe, you send them $100 and they send you back an analysis of some parts of your DNA. And for instance, in my case, they told me that deep vein thrombosis, I have a very high probability compared to the rest of the population of getting. I immediately ordered those socks you can put over when you sit on the plane for a long time and changed my behavior. I don't fly without these socks. How do we find this out? Because, you know, other people who have similar DNA SNPs as I do actually have a much more high risk to getting, you know, deep vein thrombosis. So what should be the role of insurance? And even if right now I'm comfortable for my insurance company to know my SNPs, what about in 10 years or in 20 or in 30 years from now when they find out more about people with a DNA like mine? Maybe they wouldn't insure me anymore. So these are questions about people creating data, maybe sharing data with unexpected consequences down the road. In the short term, we might have advantages. In the long term, we just don't know. It's a responsibility for us, I think, society, to think deeply what it is that we think should be happening. It's a new world we have here. Another couple of examples. Withings. Withings is a scale, electronic scale, and every morning when I'm in San Francisco, I step on it, and it is Wi-Fi connected, and it tweets out my weight. So if anybody cares, it's not that exciting. It's just twitter.com/aweigandmetrics. Now, what happens is that, first of all, I actually step on the weight and I reflect on my own data. It's just not going down. It just sucks, you know. I think I need to change my eating behavior. That's probably just stepping on the scale, I think, doesn't change the weight. Second one is I know that there is a record. And thirdly is I know that potentially, probably nobody's looking, but potentially other people could see this and I could make some commitment that I want to leave 5 pounds, and maybe I'm more likely actually to then having that in public every day to actually do something about it. So it's not important that we're talking about a scale right now. What is important is that creating and sharing data has become so trivially easy. And the examples range from my scale at home to my DNA, from who I'm interacting with, how much I'm talking, how much they are talking, to the quality of my voice. There's an iPhone app where the quality of my voice gets analyzed. What, you know, the CIA was able to do, whether I'm lying or not, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, now a $1.99 app actually does. Last example on the social playground is a company called Quora. Quora is, at the surface, just another question answering site. The interesting thing is that many very famous people actually contribute there. For instance, Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, just wrote a long post where somebody asked a simple question. Why do they do that? Why does he not spend his time playing golf? Why does he bother writing stuff in a QA session? So actually, I didn't ask him. I should. But I think it's because he can show just how good, how smart, he really is very smart, how smart he is, and people see it. And it's an accepted forum where you can discover people through questions, through content that's out there. Many other examples here. Bottom line for playgrounds is you want to build social playgrounds so people can distribute, share their data in order to get something back. Last part is, what are examples of behavior change through social data? So we already talked about the hiring process in the context of my class. Who of you, when somebody interviews, actually Googles that person? And just we can close our eyes in case that's not cool. But I want to just get a feeling about if somebody says, you know, you have to interview this person tomorrow at 10:30, who of you Googles them? almost everybody. Who of you tries to be Facebook friends with them beforehand? No? Why not? Because it's symmetrical versus Googling. One thing I've learned was every datum is a query. Now, if they knew that you actually are Googling them, would that change your behavior? Or if somebody actually clicked on all the whatever 200 pictures I have on my Facebook profile, if they knew that I knew, would that change their behavior? Or in the LinkedIn example, you know that powerful feature, somebody from this and this company in that and that position just clicked in your profile. How much is that worth it for you? So our behavior changes. And the three examples I have is customer, how to think about product, and how to think about the company culture. First, the social data revolution is nowhere but in the mind of the customer. It is that people think about their data differently. So, for instance, Twitter wouldn't have been possible without the social data revolution. And equally well, of course, the social data revolution wouldn't have been possible without technologies like Twitter. But it's not about chicken and egg, it's about the reality. It is that it happened in the mindset of consumers. Consequences are that companies, and I gave you those few examples deliberately to make the point here, should think about how can they reduce the asymmetry between them and the customer in order to gain the trust from the consumer. The mindset is that people are so used to, if they give data, to get some data. If they give attention, to get attention. That's the currency of Facebook. It's the currency of the social data economy, attention. But how can you re-engineer your thinking about your customer so you can not just look at them through a one-way mirror and observe them, but truly see them in a two-way mirror? How can you open up your company so people actually get some data from you? Yeah. Great.
I get your point about symmetry of information, but the cost to that information is not the same. Organization opening itself up to all the individuals that it interacts with, there's a higher cost for something going wrong and the liability, whereas the cost from the other end is very low. So,
interesting point. However, I told you at the beginning about the equation of the business. There's also the cost of not having the trust. So you have to carefully understand what are you losing by, for instance, let's say an agent at an airline not revealing who they are versus at another airline saying, well, this is who I am, this is my ID number. If you have any questions about this, you can contact me again. So I agree with you that, of course, we are not talking about corporate secrets, but we're talking about the taking previously private customer interactions and making them either accessible for the individual customer at least, like the example of the call with Avis, or better yet, making them acceptable for other customers. Now, what can happen is then, an example for this is a company called GetSatisfaction.com. Now, other customers can say, I have that problem too. And now you get, instead of having a call center agent not knowing how important that problem is, suddenly you get the world to prioritize what your call center, or moving straight to the product here, what your product development process should be thinking about. And thirdly, it's surprising just how many people are willing to help. Now, is this utopia? I invite you to think about a problem you recently had with some product. Say, with your phone, and just Google it and see where do you get in the first few links. And chances are you're not ending up at your carrier's website or at your phone manufacturer's website, but some random dude's blog who actually happens to have the answer for that. So do you want to be it on some random dude's blog, or do you want to create that social playground where actually people basically play with each other? Bill Joy, the former chief scientist of Sun Microsystems, once said, most smart people don't work here. And meaning, hey, help others help you. Let others play. Play with others. So all these things are trade-offs, just to be super clear. I just want to show that actually trade-offs are there, that decisions need to be made, and that there might be hidden costs. In this case, the cost of trust that we should enter into the equation. By the way, I should share my general belief that by instrumenting the world, by measuring stuff, we are able to do experiments. So why am I talking here about data all the time? Because I think by instrumenting our customer service relations, our product relations, many, many things in the world, our tweets, our Facebooks, we now can create metrics out of this, our equations of the business, which are much richer than what we had before. And that means, I'm an experimental physicist by training, that means that just doing experiments helps us do a much faster feedback loop of evolution than if we just engineer by specs. Okay. So, customer, I think we had enough examples on that. I just want to leave some, maybe 5 or so minutes for questions. For products, there are three features you should think about getting into your product. First one is the product should help people collaborate. Or in other words, it should help people coordinate whatever they want to do in new ways. And if you just think about some products, you realize a bunch of products do this really well. Some products could do it, but don't do it. Side effect of this first point is that it also serves as people discovery. So getting discovered, for instance, at Quora, or on Nike Plus, or through an Amazon review, is an interesting byproduct of having products that help people collaborate. Second one is, my mantra is, how can you help people make better decisions? So it's all about decision making. It's not just about insights, it's about decision making. How can you help your customers make better decisions? And the third one is, how do you design your product so it's easy for your customers to actually contribute? So the fast feedback loop. Most of these things actually don't cost much money. The cost is in the shift of mindset of the organization. So my last point about company culture looks at the organizational impact, looks at the innovation process. And there, my view is very simple. I probably spent 50 hours or maybe 100 hours with Jeff Bezos going through the entire organization and coming up with high granularity metrics for each group. Not just sort of generic KPIs, but, and I give you one example, the first call versus the second call to the call center. And there are thousands of these metrics. And once you have them, and once you have the buy-in of those groups, that those actually make sense, it takes some iterations. Then you run experiments day in, day out. So my belief is that getting those metrics clear, clearly communicated, is actually very hard work because they embody all the trade-offs which you are making. But in the big picture, being able to do experiments is what really helps move fast. So we developed in my lab at Stanford, the socialdatalab.stanford.edu. a little social data intelligence test, which is in beta right now and should be released probably by the end of this week. So if any of you is potentially interested in understanding where your organization stands for the first place, what insights you can get, if anybody's interested in playing with that, just go to that website or drop me a quick email, and I would love to tell you more about it. So to summarize, the data, the social data, the data people create and share, I believe, has impact in three areas, fundamental three areas. One, they dramatically change the way about who we are, our identity, questions of self-expression, and questions of privacy. Two, they dramatically change the way how we interact. And three, they dramatically change the way how we decide. And I don't mean just behavior economics that we can observe in the aggregate, how things are happening in a non-rational way. But I'm talking about how individuals make decisions. What is the social component? So it's not that they make just decisions differently, but there are some ways how we can help them make better decisions. So for me, and I would like to open it up for discussion in the last 5 minutes, the impact of the social data revolution and the art of social data, of designing it for product innovation, for the company culture, and ultimately for your customers, is what I find amazing, which hasn't happened, I think, in my lifetime before. It's just as important as having computers, connecting them, and connecting pages. So I would like to open up and see where you agree, where you disagree, what questions you have, and try to do my best answering it here from the stage. I'll be around for the entire day. So if you don't get to talk to me right now, and if you don't find me standing somewhere, then just drop me a quick email and tell me how I can find you. So yes, absolutely. The sharing behavior of people differs dramatically. And it's, by the way, not the case, definitely not the case, that my students now, that they're way more open and sharing than, you know, say, people are in this room. It's actually quite interesting. However, you don't need everybody in order to make progress on the product. We're not predicting elections where we need to have a representative sample. We want to build better products, and we want to actually take into account what people do with it so we can actually do a better job. So I think, as Facebook said in the olden days, I get whatever I can get, or whatever the expression was. I think that's the right expression here. Having people understand, however, that their experience will be a better experience if they share. For instance, if they share that they like to sit at the window, they are more likely to sit at the window, for instance, as opposed to getting maybe price discriminated against. If you want that window, see, it would be another $20.
Just to build on that question a little bit, this whole notion of, I think this kind of, and you referenced some of this, it's sort of a backlash of a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of people sharing information. Now a lot of concern as to, well, I'm not sure where that information is going to go, you know, or how it's going to be used, or will it be used against me? How do you think about sort of creating, as a company, you know, that kind of safety, that kind of security where people feel that information is not going to be used against them? against it?
So one thing I said at TED was, let's not romanticize the past. So it wasn't that the past was all that great when, you know, people actually didn't share those things. My view is that companies have to become more and more transparent. And if you think again about, I mean, you are not a sort of end user company where people actually make explicit decisions of buying. But last night we talked about Walgreens. And you know, this for me just is just a uniquely positive experience. Every time I need something there, and I'm not getting paid for this here, every time I go something there, I find it, the prescriptions are there on time and stuff like that. So I think by having a reputation and spreading this around, those companies, like say Amazon.com, who do have a good reputation, ultimately people will know this. So if you have no reputation of your company, it will be much harder for you to make, you know, a case. Just like if you have no LinkedIn profile or no Facebook profile, no presence on the internet, you know, I think it will be harder for you to get a job. There's an interesting study about 5, 6, 7 years ago on Microsoft BBS that people who actually post good answers there on average could, and I now forgot what it is, but charge a premium by just simply saying, well, if you want to know what I typically talk about, here you can go, as trust me, I'm really good at hacking that stuff. So it, I think it's all trade-offs, and the trade-offs really are where each individual, when the society needs to grow up, as companies need to grow up, and make decisions of where they want to stand in this trading off of things. It's not something which, you know, Mu Sigma can give you. Mu Sigma can help you understand, but then you need to make the trade-offs. Yes, please.
You talked about how instrumenting interactions can help create measurements that ultimately result in testing and learning. And you've talked about it in the context of people, corporations interacting with customers or consumers. But everybody in this room that's responsible for decision support is mostly trying to help their organizations make better, faster decisions within the enterprise. How do you see social media being applied to, within the four walls of the enterprise to help drive better decision making?
Okay, so actually I never talked about social media here. So I make the big distinction. I'm a data guy, not a media guy. So social media for me means just typically taking the same old PR messages and now trying to push them through Twitter, or like United now has a Facebook page. Why would I go to a United Facebook page? So let's just be clear, it was not about social media. I gave you some examples of how to instrument the organization. The example I gave at the beginning, that the second call center agent gives feedback on the first one, or that you might actually want to decide to socialize your call center answers, because I guess everybody sort of has some customer support here, were examples which I think are very much in the spirit of what a company can do without super much cost. But it's the creativity of coming up with these new terms in the creation of the business, and then all of your companies have smart people knowing what the equations are will optimize them. But also, if something is missing in the equation, then they will just as brutally optimize for the wrong thing. So I think I'd love to, I don't know what company you are with?
Mu Sigma.
Okay. So that must be then the other white guy as somebody's referring. So I would love to talk to people and do some brainstorming, maybe over lunch or something like this, of just show up maybe 10, 20, 30 of those different metrics, I think, which are part of the equation of companies, which actually I think are sometimes not, sometimes just good creative things which we came up with. Yeah, so I'm super happy to do this with you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
For the use of the data, a lot of companies prior to the 2000s had to worry about do not solicit, do not mail, privacy flags. Going forward with the blogs and the intent to share data, is there as much concern anymore on using consumer data, LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook? Is that all fair game to use in analysis and data collection?
I absolutely totally think so. So I would actually argue that any company let's say United, since I came on United yesterday. United would be well advised to find out what my username is. It's not hard. I mean, they know my email because that's how they send me their, you know, confirmations. So I think it's just the mindset that companies tend to not think that there could be relevant stuff for them. A friend of mine does customer service, Bonissimi. She was a student of mine for JetBlue. And they actually are very good in linking, and there is nothing illegal about this, in linking to the customers their Twitter names. Virgin is also quite good at this. It's not an airline talk here. But I think some companies get it. And it's also a question about sort of the DNA of the company, whether you think that going out there, you can benefit from them, and some companies don't. I did some consulting for Best Buy, and about 2 years ago at the headquarters, and one of the things we came up with, maybe 3 years ago, was that Best Buy monitors the Twitter, as probably many of you do, for, you know, their own mention, but also for products they have. And so when I was there, one of the examples was that somebody complained about a router, internet router, or DSL mode, I forgot what it is. They had bought at Circuit City, they were still around then. And so there is some digression the people at Best Buy have. That woman said, hey, if that router doesn't work, why don't we send somebody over from Geek Squad, which belongs to Best Buy, and we give you whatever, $25 off or 50% off your next purchase here. So think about, by grabbing those people's usernames, you now have a customer from a competitor who is unhappy because he bought something which doesn't work. You send somebody over who makes it work, and you give him a voucher for the next purchase. That is very different from a Super Bowl ad. Yeah. And I also did some work for a bank where we basically found the same, that, you know, somebody was tweeting about, you know, that the bank sucked. And then the head of, you know, consumer banking picked up the phone and said, what's wrong? And that woman, of course, dropped out of all skies that somebody's actually listening to her tweets. So if you link this, and it won't be perfect, 80-20. With a little bit of effort, you get probably 80% of your customers covered. Teradata actually has an effort to make this simple for people. I helped them instrument their big partners conference last year, and that was one of the things that we got people's LinkedIn profiles, stuff like this beforehand. And then make it easy for people to fix it. So I'm lucky. I don't think there's another Andreas Weigand in the world. Not everybody's as lucky as me. So then offer to the customer, as they log in into their Mileage Plus account, saying, hey, we found actually a few LinkedIn profiles. Why don't you tell us who you are, and we will hopefully not screw you, but hopefully give you a better service then. These are the potentially matches. Company which does in the background here is Rapleaf, company in San Francisco on Mission Street, or in Hoffman's company, where they go and compute your social score, sort of your risk. So for instance, if all of my friends tend to be sort of shady and I have an insurance claim to file, my insurance company might say, we don't know much about you, but we know that your friends tend to file a lot, which not always really makes sense to us. And they may make the decision to spend more resources investigating my claim than if, you know, my friends are just smooth and don't do funny things. So you can do it at an aggregate level, or you can do it on an individual level, and companies are springing up which help you with that. What do you think, actually? Let me reflect it back. What do you think, for those of you who have end users? Grab their Facebook profiles, grab their Twitter names, grab their LinkedIn profiles, see who they're connected to. I mean, it's public information. It's a summer intern's job. I still have a couple of students who look for summer internships. So Any opinions? Is it evil? The big question, of course, is what if they at some stage decide to no longer share the information with the world? That's when it gets interesting, sort of this sort of ownership of data. And then if they don't make it public anymore, but you still know that they had that girlfriend in Puerto Rico someday and try to tell them that, you know, there are good sales going on to go to Puerto Rico. So what we saw here is that we started with DIP and we realized that the data part is, I think, where most thinking is needed, and the actions part, the behavior change part. But none of this would be possible if we didn't have here the DIP framework and Mu Sigma in the center. I think we have reached the end of my presentation in terms of timing. If people still have questions, I'm around. But otherwise, let me thank you for your attention. Thank you. Hello. Good.
I'm Raj. I'm from Dell.
Mm-hmm. If you had been a Dell computer, this wouldn't have happened that we had 5 minutes of. Now we can talk. Oh, good.
Yeah.
I will be there. I mean, I want to learn as much as I can learn here, what people's questions are. So,
good morning, everyone. Now includes the next topic.
Do you want to talk outside for a second?
Let's go
outside. I leave my stuff here. Maybe just grab some food here. Thank you. Want to grab right here?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Nothing compared to what you do. But no, I want people to think about the opportunities they have in this world.
You know what? You know, in fact, Rajiv and I from Dell, we were anyway going to come to you. But I think the thinking behind, you know, what people don't understand, the big difference between social media and social data is so big. And what you said about, companies starting to design for
data,
the behavior that will create the right data, you know, and be accepting of that is critical. I find that not there yet. I don't think they have got to that mindset where they are designing for that, you know, that.
Yes.
If I, what are the things that I will do so that I'll get the right kind of behavior from my, you know,
and
constituents?
But Mu Sigma enables them to get there. Because, thank you, because if they didn't have somebody who can do the math for them, they wouldn't have the mental bandwidth of saying, well, we have somebody who cleans our stuff and who does the math. You know, honestly, this is really why I want to work.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, like, let's say, people build data warehouses. Typically, once sort of the thing is somewhat working, they're out of energy and they don't even know what they build it for anymore. But hey, it's working. What did we build it? Not my problem. I'm exhausted, product overdue, was more expensive. So I think by being able to say, look, don't worry about this part. You do your experiments, and we help you actually figure out what really was going on. That's why I lifted it up and said, now let's actually think, what do we do given that Mu Sigma has solved the problem?
Yeah. I think we are solving, I should say, but no, yeah, I would, uh, I think what we are doing at Dell actually is very similar to what you're talking about, what you talked about at Best Buy, but actually they have put together, which is wonderful, a listening center.
Mm. I've heard about this. I had a student in my class 2 years ago, 3 years ago, no, 2 years ago, who was at Dell as an intern, I think. I forgot her name. But she also complained that marketing, and so she complained that the people, like in the product, they don't benefit from the listening center. So I think she complained about organizational silos, not data silos, but organizational silos. That I forgot.
The listening center was very informal until about maybe 6 months back. Now we have formalized it. Now there are definite conduits running.
So how so that's actually for me the main question. How do you actually change, let's say, the product or the call center or something based on what's happening in the listening center?
Yeah.
If the listening center is just people picking answer number 333 for that customer and they're quiet, then you don't benefit as a company in doing it. So that for me is the key question. Do you socialize, do you use the social data?
Oh yes. So what we have done, again.
Yeah, sure. We'll go back in a second.
Right.
Yeah.
No. So yeah, it's not perfect, it's not complete, it's a long journey. Right now we have started using social data more in the reactive phase. And the proactive use of the data is, I think, just beginning to happen. There are evangelists, and we have friends who are evangelizing that use. What we have seen in instances where we launch a product and we've already gone through the entire testing process, and then there are this noise that you start hearing.
Yeah.
And then you put the lens on it, and then you suddenly amplify that, and you actually, what would have either never surfaced or what would have taken months to surface, we diagnosed it like 5 days after launch. And we stopped shipment of more than 5,000 computers that day, corrected it. 5,000 unhappy customers.
Less. 5,000 unhappy customers less.
Yeah. And then so many 50,000 phone calls.
I mean, yes.
And the loss of trust, and you talk about trust raises. That is bone chilling for me. I think the social media center, the command center, paid for itself.
Yes. This is, I know, itself. This is what people don't understand, that we are not trying to sell them expensive systems. Mm. We're not SAP. We are selling them basically, in the bigger picture, cheap stuff, which has a huge difference.
But I think you also hit upon something which I actually am trying to cover in my humble talk also. Social data, social media will not change. No. You have to change yourself as a culture and then use social media. You can use that as a galvanizing agent, you can use that as a catalyst. But if there is no appetite for changing stuff or processes, I as a data guy can keep on pumping as much as you want into your inboxes. And then
that's where the metrics play the role. I mean, Amazon, it really is amazing how much mental energy and time of, you know, CEO and this chief scientist was spent on coming up with these equations of the business. And if your bonus is, you know, tightly coupled with getting those second calls to the call center down, not to sort of drive this example home to death, but if that's what your bonus depends on, you will find ways of actually doing it.
Yeah, that's how we drive behavior, isn't it?
Yeah.
Planning incentives.
Yeah.
People become what you measure. Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Which is so common, isn't it?
But now we have the granularity. That's what I try to make sure is, they used to have metrics like number of calls taken in the call center, okay? Yeah. That means, hey, are we done now? Yes, thank you, boom. We're not done, never mind, boom, right? Mm-hmm. Like the Avis guy. I don't know. I mean, yeah, for me, that's unbelievable.
I have had the same experience with T-Mobile. You know, I had a conversation where they said, we waived the $200 charge off of your bill. And then next call, $200 plus.
Yeah. So. Yes, and we are now able to actually surface, to socialize those things. And those companies, like Amazon, who tend to do a good job, I mean, they can command a premium, and and just the, overall, it's a fair world. And what I wanted to get to with this, having, you know, customers playing on the playground, not all of it, if you socialize things, not all of it actually has to be your employees who actually did. I did a workshop at Nokia where this example came from, which I said, you know, if you Google something, it turns out that actually I thought it was Nokia employee who solved that problem. Because I was in Espoo, right. And they'd never heard of the guy. It was just a fan who really thought, oh, I know how to do this. So if you actually sort of open it up and have some rudimentary machine learning in it, we're not talking about state-of-the-art models here, that people can vote things up and can vote things down. If, you know, if people find it useful, it bubbles up. People don't find it useful, it bubbles down. And you pay $1,000 for something which tries to remove spam. You suddenly have all your happy customers actually trying to help your customer service. But it's a difficult mindset shift.
No, you're so right, and that's, I often do this, what's the value of an advocate? Something like 85% of the math I do, or the analytics I do, goes into proving that this is a wall, right? People are asking, okay, what's the value of, what's the value of, of an advocate? What's the value of a promoter? Okay, I mean, what's the value of your brother? Can you figure that out?
I mean, you can do experiments, okay, which actually, for instance, you can remove reviews, and you find out that the review is roughly worth $50, the first review of an item. So you do experiments.
I
haven't thought about it really exactly what your definition is of an adequate, but hey, once you know and your CEO signs off and saying, this is what we believe our equation of the business is for this year, then you can compute the value of an advocate. If he is not sure, because...
No, my challenge is not proving the value of an advocate. I can't do that. And I've done that value of my Facebook
which
fan,
is a question.
My Twitter. It's a question which is annoying. It's like, anyway, but we'll prove it. Because people, I think, and it's fair. It's a fair question from a person who is trying to wrap his or her mind around it.
Right.
Hey.
Very inspiring, the speech.
I tried to.
But I'm keeping you away from your fruit.
No worries. I mean, I'm here for you guys. The fruit, fruit or not fruit.
Your throat might be dry.
Oh no! I mean, whatever you want to do, whatever you want to do.
Why don't you take him there? And I'll just make a trip to the boys and come back.
Okay. Rajiv, obviously, do you have a card?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Actually, I...
Let's stay in touch.
Yes. I mean, I'll be here.
I'll be around.
Can I get one from you as well?
Sure. Okay. This is my old title, but yes, I'm still...
Great. So, yeah.
Still
yes.
Prashant is leading the Mu Sigma team.
Ah, great.
Site.
Great.
We have actually quite a large team. Working on, I should say, massaging, manipulating.
It's I really believe in, otherwise I wouldn't be saying it, that by Mu Sigma, basically taking that part and you don't having to worry about that, you can now worry about, actually, as I said, the data and about the behavior change, as opposed to, you know, getting bogged down with,
Can I have yoga?
It's on my backpack. I don't have it right now. Come by. Yeah, sorry.
No. Worries. You'll be here all day.
Yeah, I'll be here all day, and I simply, you know, when I get on stage, I left it on my backpack.
I'll see you in a
bit. Or I can just send you your emails there. I'll just send you a quick email, then you have my information, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Sure. Hugo. You guys are doing a good job.
It's been really exciting. So, I mean, Raj and me met like a year ago in the parking lot. And Raj was like, okay, we need to figure out this social media thing. Because Dell is thinking of going into using it as a marketing vehicle. And then basically we sat down for about 3 weeks, came up with an entire framework of how we should be thinking about using social media for engaging with the customers and measuring impact. And it's been a...
Let's grab fruit, yeah.
And what do they use to help get inventory at the right store at the right time? So it's forecasting. So now you got three different groups trying to solve the exact same problem. So that's the important
good,
part.
You're doing a good job.
You got a lot of smart people in those areas.
Is,
they're focused on
as with any
So we were kind of leaning toward the centralized model. Unfortunately, unlike some of the internet companies, you know, the Microsofts, the Facebooks, and some